shores of El Pacifico. Bill Hendry.
A lot of things have changed since the last time we were together. One of those things is that, John...
Right now, we bill it by twos. We're the only service that bill us by twos.
But it does sort of remind me of Groundhog Day in the sense that Senator Bunning...
I have an Obama-Biden bumper sticker on my car.
Did you ever smoke, Wolf?
No, not really.
He's a racist. I hate him.
World-famous Phil Hendry Show here every night till 1 o'clock on the West Coast, 4 a.m. on the East Coast, the news talk and entertainment show that knows what it's talking about. Truth is our bitch. If you don't believe me, just check out the homepage of our brand-new redesigned website. Brand-new redesigned website, and we opened it up for business at 7 o'clock Pacific tonight, 10 o'clock Eastern. Go over there. Go to our Phil feed. You can comment. You can look at some of the thoughts we're having this evening on our Phil feed. You can also... look at the live streaming video and listen to the live streaming audio. It's video audio on the site every night. Go over there. Look at our archives. We've got a huge archive. Greg moved all of it over. All of that stuff is going to be converted eventually into it. All of it downloadable. But right now it's there. And some of it is downloadable. Some of it's really old, man. I mean, some of it's like 1996, you know.
Yeah, what is that, 1996 or something? What is that about?
Well, you know, they had radio then, bud.
Yeah, but I mean... we didn't even know you then.
Oh, really? Well, that doesn't mean I didn't exist. I was doing radio in 1996. We got a 1996 show on there somehow. And I'm going to say this because he's a great man. Matt Groening, the creator of The Simpsons, has the first 3 years of our shows that we did in Los Angeles. He has it on cassette tape.
Why don't you call him up? Have him take it over here.
Well, it's not that I'm going to call the guy up. Hey, Mr. Groening, would you mind just loading all those tapes into your car and bringing them to my house? You know,
well, you got to get them, man.
Well, and he said I could have them. So I don't know. But in any event, we have lots more to add to our archive. We have a merchandise store that we're opening up. We have, as I mentioned, we've got our news feed that you can check in on and also add your comments to. It's all there on our website at philhendryshow.com. That's philhendryshow.com. And there's a bunch of stuff I'm forgetting because I just don't, you know, right now we're in a little bit of a rush. But we opened everything up at 7 o'clock Pacific, and we're rock and roll, and we're ready for business right now. See, what else? The stuff that we're thinking of doing. Oh, we're going to get a chat room going on our video feed eventually. So we're really happy to have been able to consolidate the site. We've got it on a platform now that's a lot more up to date. And the thing that I want you to always remember, if you come to our site and you're looking at and listening to the show, in other words, you're watching and listening to the video and to the audio of the show that is streaming on our site, it is state of the art. Our video is state of the art video casting. You can look at all these other cats that are doing their shows via the video cast. Ours is top of the line, the best, the best quality, which in my case, you know, looking at me, you know.
Yeah, it might be a bad thing, you know.
God, spit it out, will you?
Yeah, man, what are you, like, retarded?
I got something stuck.
Yeah. Okay, 877-877, you got something stuck, all right. 877-876-PHIL. Tonight's Crime Night on the world-famous Phil Hendry Show, and Crime Night means Dr. Michael Stone. As we spotlight our affiliates this evening in Tucson, KJLL 1330 AM, Tucson, Arizona, and in Augusta, Georgia, which is the home of the Mastas, WNRR 1260 AM in Augusta. Great to have you guys with us on our Phil Hendry network of stations. Dr. Michael Stone will join us this evening to talk on Crime Night. Once a month, we have Dr. Stone on with us, and he will be talking with us tonight, I think, about the Jeffrey McDonald case. That guy was a real piece of work, that guy.
What'd he do?
Well, Jeffrey McDonald was a Green Beret, and I say that because this is a very high level of achievement in the United States Army. He was a Green Beret. He was an airborne guy. He was one of the creme de la creme, man, stationed at Fort Bragg, I think, in North Carolina. And in the early 1970s, and I believe he was a Vietnam veteran, and he was highly, you know, he was decorated, and he was just a guy who, he commanded the respect of all around him. Now, he had a wife and he had two daughters. And sometime in the early 1970s, and Dr. Stone will take you through this, but it's really an interesting story. And it's very tragic, too.
Yeah, you say that's more, you say it's tragic.
Yeah, you're pretending like you think it's tragic.
No, I ain't pretending, okay? I'm just saying it's interesting, but yes, it's tragic. It's been a long time, all right? It's been a long time.
Yeah, but more you think it's bitching.
What do you mean more I think it's bitching? Don't you understand, bud, that sometimes you can think of something as interesting that was at one time very tragic? You know?
Well, like what?
Well, like, let's say Lincoln's assassination. At one time, I'm sure the country was in shock. Now it's more interesting. I mean, it's sad, but it's interesting. You know?
I'm still very troubled by it.
Get out of here, will you?
You're joking.
Oh, do you think he's joking? So anyway, Jeffrey McDonald had this wife and these daughters. Now, this was after the Manson murders. And so I say after the Manson murders, it didn't surprise anybody all that much, although it was still very shocking, when Jeffrey McDonald's wife and daughters turned up dead, murdered in their home. And I believe Jeffrey McDonald is a doctor. Dr. McDonald, either unconscious or in some state of disrepair and dishevelment and semi-consciousness. And he claimed that a group of hippies came in and, you know, slaughtered his wife and children. And sure enough, on the walls, I think there was something written, acid is groovy. That was it. Acid in blood. Acid is groovy. All right. So, of course, the community's outraged. They're stunned, and they're saddened for the doctor and his lovely wife and the kids. I mean, that's the part that breaks your heart more than anything. And it's horrible. And into town, by the way, comes this guy, McGinnis. I think his name is Joe McGinnis, the writer. Joe McGinnis is going to write a book about this. And he is feeling just as bad as everybody else about Jeffrey McDonald, the colonel in the Green Beret, and he is getting Jeffrey McDonald's story. And in comes Jeffrey McDonald's father-in-law, who becomes very pivotal in this story. Freddie, I think is his. I don't forget the man's last name. And these men are very solicitous to Jeffrey McDonald, and they want to help him, and they want to, geez, what can we do? I'm going to write the story of this. This is a tragedy. Well, Joe McGinnis is a writer, and he's a journalist, and that means he's not an idiot. And as he investigates this story more and more, it begins to occur to him that, in his opinion anyway, something don't smell too good, you know.
Yeah, like maybe it wasn't a hippie.
Like maybe it wasn't no hippie, exactly. Like maybe it was the doc.
Oh, he thought the doc did it, huh?
That's what he began to think, see? And so Joe McGinnis went from a guy that went into town to write this book of the terrible thing that happened to his family to, geez, I think this doctor did it. I think this guy, Jeffrey McDonald, did it. And Joe McGinnis eventually found a confederate, a compatriot, someone who agreed with him, in the father-in-law, who also began to question his son-in-law's story and alibi. And so began the downfall, the unraveling of Jeffrey McDonald. And he eventually did go on trial, and I don't know, was he acquitted or some jazz? This took a long time, man, 7-8 years for this cat to eventually get convicted. And he did get convicted, and he is now in prison, and I believe he's now got some new court case. He's got some new bunch of horse dung that he wants to throw at the court, like, you know, my rights were, geez. And, you know, as we've talked on the show about psychopaths, these guys, they want to control everything, right?
Yeah, well, they're in jail. What do they care about anything? They're going to waste everybody's time.
Exactly. They're going to waste your time because they got to, it's boring.
Right.
It's boring in jail. So if you're a psychopath, you want to mess with people and you want to control things. So that's what this jackass is doing. He's still got people that believe he's innocent. There's a lot of people who want to believe that people are innocent. You know, there's a lot of people. If you say it enough times, man, there's going to be somebody who's going to believe you. You know, they go, well, you know, maybe you got something. You know, maybe, oh, yeah, of course I've got something, man. I didn't do it. I'm telling you. You know what I believe? And then these women that marry them and stuff. So Dr. Stone's going to get into that. We're also going to get into that guy, that serial killer, the guy who was on the dating game, that Alcala guy. Ooh, man. You know, you want to look at him or just go ahead and take batting practice. Which is it? So that's coming up here in just a second on Crime Night with Dr. Michael Stone. We're going to discuss the Alcala story. By the way, Joe McGinnis eventually turned his investigation into Jeffrey McDonald and the murder of his wife and children into a fantastic book called Fatal Vision, which eventually was turned into a movie of the week, starring, among others, Gary Cole, the great Carl Malden, Eva Marie Saint. That was a hell of a movie. And Fatal Vision is a great book. It's still a great book, so you should pick it up and read it. 877-876-PHIL. So we got Dr. Stone, Crime Night, coming up later on tonight. Emery Clayton is going to join us, and Jack Armstrong, liberal blogger. So it's going to be an action-packed night tonight. The world-famous Phil Hendry Show.
That's weird.
Phil Hendry.
Welcome back here on the world-famous Phil Hendry Show, and at the end of another beautiful month, the month of March, in like a lion, going out like a lamb, we have with us Dr. Michael Stone. He is the great forensic psychiatrist, host of the former Discovery ID show Most Evil, available now on DVD at Amazon.com. He's also the author of a terrific book, The Anatomy of Evil. Dr. Stone is also on faculty there at Columbia University and takes his wife every week or every so often to a beautiful Broadway play so she forgives his gothic studies there in the deepening gloom of his study. And here he is with us. How's that for a build up, Doc? I mean, I got you. You're like Dr. Jekyll now.
That's right.
Yeah. You know, Doc, I was in New York this past weekend, and I was going to call on you, but I was at an industry function, didn't have any time. But I did see the shows on Broadway, and I thought of you. So what did you go see?
We saw a terrific play by Valerie Harper acting as Tallulah Bankhead, and it was a show about her toward the end of her life and how she was...
Wow.
Yeah, it was fabulously acted. It had many of her famous one-liners and so on. It was really very good. It was a real tour de force by Valerie Harper, the actress.
Valerie Harper, who was in the Mary Tyler Moore show, Rhoda?
Gee, I'm not sure about that. She's a pretty well-known actress. Yeah.
I think of Tallulah Bankhead. I think of that movie Lifeboat by Alfred Hitchcock. However, that was a made-up mystery. We're talking about real things here with Dr. Stone, and we have two stories and probably more that we're going to get into tonight with Dr. Michael Stone, but one of them is Rodney Alcala, and maybe we ought to just get this weirdo out of the way, Doc, before we talk about Jeffrey McDonald, these others, because everybody this week has seen the video of this strange man on the dating game back in the 70s, and even as far back as then, and I suppose this is hindsight, he looked like a dangerous guy. He looked like a narcissist or whatever term you want to slap on it. You know, someone who definitely thought he was the star of the show.
Well, people, even back then, the women on that dating game or whatever it was, a television mm-hmm. show, mm-hmm. or Bachelor, something to do with, would he be your number one bachelor you'd want to date?
Bachelor, right. Yeah.
Some of the women... backed out of having him as the date or because he looked very creepy, or he just gave them a very uncomfortable feeling.
No kidding.
And this was back, around the time that he actually had begun to do his serial killing. He raped and almost killed that little girl, Tali Shapiro. She managed to survive. He was convicted of child molestation. But California at that time felt that rapists and murderers could be cured through education and psychotherapy. Lots of luck there. So they let him go. And so he becomes an example of what I always like to call premature release, where someone's done a horrific crime and they're given the benefit of the doubt that they don't really deserve. Then they go on to commit more horrific crimes.
Yeah. Seattle police said today, Dr. Stone, that detectives are looking for links between Alcala and two Seattle women, aged 13 and 17, who were killed in the 70s. Have you been up on that at all?
Yes.
I know it just broke today. Yeah? Can you tell us about that?
Well, I think they found a cache of photographs up there. Somebody was reluctant to cooperate with the police, but finally, they got a hold of them, and they're now trying to match the faces of some of those presumed killed or very severely damaged girls back in the 70s to actual people. Maybe some parents recognized their missing child was one of those girls.
Dr. Stone, this man Alcala It's possible that he killed a lot of women. And yet he was arrested and he has been incarcerated for decades.
Yes.
It seems to me, though, even though he has been arrested and has been incarcerated, that only the story of this man is now coming out, the story of how brutal and how violent and how murderous this man is. Did anybody know that he was a serial killer before this year or the last few years? When did the real full story of this guy, Alcala, come out?
Maybe not the... Well, it seems to me that in 78 and 79, there was a series of murders. There were four women, at least, that were killed, I think, in California. There was this Georgia Wickstead, and Jill Barcombe, Charlotte Lamb, and Jill Parenteau. They were, I believe, in their 20s or late teens, so he did both young women and also teenagers and even children. So he did pedophilic murders as well as the regular adult murders. I think somebody was on to him in the late 70s, and that's why he was given a 3-year sentence. And it was only after that, and I think after they began in 79 finally, you know, to peg him as a serial killer, and then they put him on death row. But then, of course, the judge reversed it because they said that they shouldn't have told that he was guilty of a child molestation some years earlier, that wasn't fair. And so it went back and forth like that. Finally, I think in the last week or so, he's actually been convicted and given the death sentence all over again, which means that he's...
All over again.
You're staring at him in San Quentin as you look out the window, I suppose, and there he is.
Yeah. Well, all right, so here's a guy that was given the death penalty once, and he's been given the death... Of course, he's got the death penalty in California, which, you know, the cynics among us, I'm one of them, basically means life imprisonment. I mean, Richard Ramirez is still alive. You know, Richard Ramirez is still alive. So
Larry Bittaker's been there for 20 years.
Yeah, Lawrence Bittaker, I mean, that guy. That's a life sentence. So here is a guy who is a serial killer. I would like to know from you, Dr. Stone, because you just made the statement, these guys, it's a joke to think that they can be rehabilitated, and I'm grateful that you and other wise men like you say that. Is there anything more to learn from these guys? Can you guys do any more MRIs, look at any more brain cavities, look at any more blood? You know, is there anything more to know about these guys that might point us in the direction of keeping them from being created or otherwise getting worse?
I don't know about being created, but I think they can be. Some of them can be spotted. For instance, this guy comes across, like Ted Bundy, as a very chilly, charming outwardly, but very chilly person. As a matter of fact, he was even similar to Ted Bundy in that he was identified partly through the teeth marks in one of his victims, as was Bundy.
Right.
He didn't suffer head injury, as far as we know. He had a high IQ like Larry Bittaker. I could see them playing bridge there. You know, now that Stano was executed, now there's another bridge hand. He doesn't have to...
Another bridge player.
So that
do you play bridge? Dr. Stone, do you play bridge? Because you could fill out a foursome. I might be interesting.
Yeah. So Alcala, very bright and very callous person. So you could spot some of these callous, unemotional youngsters through MRI, and you could begin to see that there's something not right about some of the... like the hippocampus, some parts of the brain, the frontal lobe, and parts of the limbic system that aren't working up to snuff, and that point the way, you know, to the possibility of committing a lot of very callous, heartless crimes. Those are genetic factors. The ones that, in addition, have serious head injuries, like Shawcross, and so on. That's another group. You can spot that they've had serious head injuries, especially in the frontal areas. They're at risk, you know, for committing crimes. But the ones that are really the most worrisome and dangerous are these really chillingly cold, unemotional 10 and 11 and 12-year-old boys.
Wow. Oh, man. I had a friend of mine who was a nurse at the University of Washington, and she was doing her internship, and she said she counseled a boy who had been involved in some kind of arson and animal torture. And she said, boy, she said she was tempted to send this kid's DNA off to the FBI just by talking to him, you know. But let me, and I'm sure you've had those encounters, Dr. Stone. I want to ask you about that and about Jeffrey McDonald. Our old friend Jeffrey McDonald is back in the news. The Green Beret, murderer of his wife and children. The world-famous Phil Hendry Show, our number, 877-876-PHIL. We are on with Dr. Stone here on Crime Night. We'll be right back with Michael Stone.
Phil Hendry.
Phil, and with us is Dr. Michael Stone, the forensic psychiatrist and author of Anatomy of Evil and host of Most Evil on Investigation Discovery, and also a man who testified in a rather famous case, the case that got you, Dr. Stone, started in what you call the murder business, or the business of being a forensic psychiatrist, and that is the case of Jeffrey McDonald, the Fatal Vision Killer, the Green Beret Killer. And I was giving the audience some background, Dr. Stone, the very first quarter hour of the show about McDonald and the clean-cut Green Beret and his wife and kids were killed. Can you kind of take us through that horrible murder and the aftermath?
Well, the some of the more interesting things were data that never really came out at even the second trial where he was convicted because mm-hmm. they involved hearsay. Colette, the wife, had been apparently taking psychology classes, and wow. one evening came home unexpectedly early and apparently found that Jeffrey was doing something inappropriate with the older girl, Kimberly. I think she presumed that he was molesting her sexually in some way, and she said, "If you do that again, I'll kill you." This was heard by neighbors upstairs through the air conditioning vents or whatever. And, of course, it's hearsay, so that never came out at trial.
Yeah.
Long mm-hmm. story short, he then stabbed her many times, bludgeoned and stabbed, the children. And, the number of stabbing, something like 37 stab wounds, is always expressive of rage. He tried to blame it a la Manson, with the, as if it was hippies who invaded the place.
Right.
He talked about four hippies. The interesting thing to me was that it was really four murders, because when you kill a pregnant woman, that's two, and the two girls. So the four hippies was Jeffrey himself talking about writing in the wall, the pigs or whatever, Compton Manson. He had his bag packed, according to the stepfather of Colette, Freddie Kassab, but then he decided that he could maybe outsmart, the police, and so he didn't flee, as was his original intention, and then he tried to stage the crime as if there was a home invasion. But
Dr. Stone, what year did this take place? So we get 70? This Manson 1970.
So in February of 70.
Yeah. So the Manson murders had just taken place 6 months before, thereabouts.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And 37 stabbings means rage. A home invasion murder that's usually done swiftly by an accomplished killer with one or two either pistol shots or a few stabbings, but not 37. So when you have that number, you're talking about somebody who's furiously angry, because his whole reputation was now on the line, because if she went ahead and mounted a suit against him for child molestation or something like that, his career as a physician would be ruined. And by the way, another thing that was not even relevant to the trial, I have a colleague in New York who went to analytic school with me at Columbia, where he himself had been an intern at Columbia at one time, but I think they both went to Northwestern Medical School, and he had that contemptuous, arrogant quality came out when there was an auditorium that the medical students often go to when a professor wants to illustrate something, and he had the professor had a girl come down and examine a patient or something, and there is Jeffrey McDonald somewhere in the group of medical students, whispering in a very loud whisper, "Pussy, pussy," to humiliate the girl. My colleague,
weird.
there hearing that, and so that there was, he had a nasty streak going way back, you know, to, yeah, to medical school. And then when he's finally convicted after the second trial, and Joe McGinnis had to rewrite the book because they became friends after the first trial, and then Joe realized that he was betrayed by this guy. He was conned by this guy and didn't,
yeah,
he was innocent.
Yeah.
Then he called him, McGinnis, narcissistic and antisocial. Okay. And McDonald is suing him, you know, how dare you call me these terrible names, and where's my, yeah, royalty money? You and I agreed to share royalty money, which, of course, if you murder somebody, you don't collect royalty money. So I was brought out.
Not only
help
that, but you're not going to be if he didn't want to be called narcissistic, but by the same token, he was called narcissistic in a book that probably wouldn't have sold had he not been, and he wants the royalties from it.
Yeah.
Oh,
so,
wow. Okay.
So I helped to defend McGinnis, the author, and by way of backing up that these names were appropriate, I was sent by the attorneys about 1,000 pages, which McDonald himself had dictated into a tape recorder and then was transcribed. So I had all this stuff, you know, in my possession, and I thought, well,
oh, man,
it's so filled with arrogant, narcissistic-type comments. I pulled 4 pages at random out without it, and just had them copied, Xerox copied, and gave them to a class of psychology students up at Columbia, you know, and Cornell, uh-huh, when I was teaching there. And I said, here's some material, look at it and tell me what you think. And every single one said narcissistic, a few said hysterical, a few said antisocial, but they all came across, they all made the correct impression, narcissistic. And so I spoke about that, you know, to Jennifer.
Did you, Dr. Stone, did you, were you deposed, or did you walk into a courtroom with Jeffrey McDonald there?
I walked into a courtroom, mm-hmm, and it was a very scary experience because this guy had what in my trade we call the 1,000-yard stare, which, mm-hmm, just looks right through you and, like, bores a hole through you. And I remember there was another doctor that also examined, the two of us had given testimony, I should say, at the trial. And we both felt very nervous being in the room with this fellow, and both of us had to go to the men's room and pee a few extra times. It was that,
whoa,
disconcerting,
yeah,
I can tell you, to be in the room, especially talking about his pathology with him staring right in front of you.
Hey, Dr. Stone, I've often heard it said of guys like Jeffrey McDonald or Ted Bundy or any one of these psychopaths that really what you call the 1,000-yard stare is a 1,000-yard stare, but it's the stare of a predator on,
yes,
prey.
That's right.
That, in other words, yeah, you're nothing more, you, me, the average person are nothing more than something they need to kill or consume to get out of their way.
Yes, that's right. I mean, we have binocular vision, and we can look straight ahead at something the way cats can look at a mouse far away. But it, mm-hmm, it's but the person who has that so-called 1,000-yard stare does it in a particularly fixed way that is very scary and menacing.
We're talking to Dr. Michael Stone, forensic psychiatrist, about Jeffrey McDonald, the fatal vision killer. I wanted to ask you, Dr. Stone, about two things. I wanted to ask about Joe McGinnis. When he finally realized that he had been conned, he eventually did revise his book. The book Fatal Vision is a terrific book. Was it published before with a different conclusion that McDonald was innocent, or had he finished the book at all? You know, in other words, was he in the process of completing it and changed his conclusion?
He was in the process of completing it and then changed it, so it didn't come out in two versions. Okay. It came out in the version that we know it.
Now, McDonald is involved in some other little machination now. He's still in prison. Where's he in jail at?
Oh, golly, where is he in jail?
Is he in California?
He was in California the last I knew.
Mm-hmm. Is he involved in some kind of a legal thing now? Is he doing some dance now?
I think he's trying, yes, to see if there aren't ways of saying the prosecution, you know, didn't do things properly or whatever, you know, so that he can win some kind of release.
Yeah, but lots of luck.
Appeal, basically.
Yeah. I just think that guy and all of those people that continue to call themselves innocent, even years after people have lost any kind of belief or faith in them. It's pretty fascinating. We're going to talk a little bit about killer wives now, Doc. Michelle Michael, Jessica Bates McCord, and other so-called killer wives, or husbands charred, wives charged, is I think the way you wanted to call this segment.
Yes. By the way,
you are quoted
McDonald
here.
Is in Cumberland, Maryland. He's moved from Cumberland, Maryland.
That's a federal prison. Would that be a federal prison because he was military? Or
yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. Well, let's talk about these wives that set fire to their husbands. I mean, what in the name of everything holy? So, you have a couple of biographies of women who burned their husbands to death in order to destroy evidence. Tell me about the killing of a husband on the part of wives. I know there's a lot of different motives. Sometimes it has to do with jealousy, and sometimes it's just get him out of the way because I want the money. What's the story with these?
These
two.
Get the husband out of the way. These women all were in the nursing profession. They all had access, the ones that burned them anyway. There's three that I have. They all were involved with other men. They wanted to leave their husbands and consummate an affair, you know, with another man, and want their husband out of the way. In order to sweeten the pie, they also had insurance policies such that if something happened to the husband, especially accidentally, they would get $500,000 or more. That was another motive. But the main motive was just to get him out of the way so that they could be free, unencumbered, you know, to be with another guy. And they used drugs that a nurse would have access to that most people would not. They used these curare-like drugs that immobilize a person, you know, like when you have an operation.
Paralyze.
You're paralyzed. You can't move a muscle. And then, you know, a surgeon would intubate you and keep your breathing, you know, mechanically, and you don't twitch or move or disturb, you know, the surgical feel. That's all very well when it's done properly, but in this case, the poor guy was immobilized and died knowing that he was about to die because you're fully conscious. It's really horrific. And then
that's horrible.
And then the place was set fire. As if one could destroy the evidence, and you know these people belong to the large group of killers that I call too clever by half, because they think they can get away with it, they can outsmart the police, and that they can, you know, just the evidence will be destroyed, there'll be just nothing but ashes and so on, and it's really not that easy. One of the guys was charred to the point of unrecognizability, but by golly, because the woman closed the door to the bedroom when she went back to the hospital to make it look like she never left, the fire was not as consuming as it otherwise would have been, so the bedroom was pretty done in, but nevertheless, it wasn't a complete consumption of the body, and so the liver and the heart, they were able to extract the metabolites of this drug, and between that and a lot of other evidence, they were able to put together that in the way that she left and then rushed back, you know, to the hospital, that they could compile evidence that really convicted her.
Convict them, yeah. I want to take a break, Dr. Stone, and continue on with the women that kill.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you may not know anything about the case, but I saw something last night on TV about a very famous case of a woman that killed, or possibly a woman that killed, that I'll ask you about. And everybody knows the case. I'll be back and I'll give you the name of this lady in a moment. The world famous Phil Henry Show. We have Dr. Michael Stone on with us, and it is Crime Night. Back after this.
Phil Henry.
Our number is 877-876-PHIL. Coming up in the ensuing hours, Professor Emery Clayton, and we'll also have Jack Armstrong. We have Dr. Michael Stone with us from most evil and a great many things. He's also a professor of forensic psychiatry at Columbia, and he's on with us monthly for our crime night. I was going to ask you, Dr. Stone, about Lizzie Borden, but you know what? She wasn't even convicted, and it's a famous case.
Well, she probably was guilty. She probably was guilty. I think that one of the things that's left a cloud of doubt hanging over the case, but goes back to 1892 after all, is that she was from this ostensibly respectable family, and it was very hard for people of that era, in that kinder, gentler era, to imagine that a girl could have taken an axe and done what she had done, to her parents. Yeah. Even though there's really nobody else that's emerged as a reasonable other suspect. So she probably did, even though it was a very bloody crime and not what you would think from this rather prim and not terribly attractive and rather rigid woman, restrained woman, that she would do that. But, sometimes when people explode after a long time of pent-up anger at her rather well-off but kind of cheapskate father, the most likely answer is that she was responsible.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's so many stories from that era that I'm sure you've, of women just dropping their five children down a well. Just all of a sudden they're done with it. They don't want to be mothers anymore. I wanted to kind of move on with this story, what we were talking about when you were mentioning these women trying to cover up their murders. Now, I have to ask you, Doc, and we were laughing about this, because Jay says to me, I said, I don't know. He says, come on, go ahead, ask Dr. Stone, how would you commit a murder to not be discovered? Now, I don't want you to give advice to the potential murderer out there, but let's start from this particular place where today in the modern age of DNA, it seems like that's the first thing you have to think about: hair, blood, and not to mention the ballistics of the weapon you're using, if you're using a gun. How do you go about, in this modern age, committing a murder and not being caught?
Well, what some of the, and they're often spousal murders, more husbands killing wives than vice versa, what some of them have done is kill the wife, try to do it in the least bloody fashion, such as by strangling, for example, and then take the body in the wee hours to the town dump, especially at a time when they know that there's a lot of more trucks going to be unloading garbage and whatever at the dump at that time, so that there'll be a good opportunity, for the body, to be buried in such a way that it won't be discovered. And some of them really have not been discovered, but then there's been other evidence that the guy was not as careful about that implicated him. But then there have been other situations where the police, knowing that that is a common way, that some of these men have tried to disappear their wives, that they've gone to the town dump and they've dug the damn thing up at tremendous expense, maybe $1 million, and days and days and weeks of, and they finally unearthed the bones that then matched.
That's right.
So it's a lot harder than you think. I think that's one of the reasons that these women that I mentioned tried, to burn, thinking that they could convert the husband to ashes. That would be an even cleverer than putting him in the town dump. But even then, they make these phenomenal mistakes. For example, this one I mentioned, I think to Jason, Kimberly Huditsko, she wanted to be with another guy, and she injected this curare drug to her husband. But then she set him afire with an accelerant, but she propped him up with a cigar in his mouth as though the cigar, caused the fire. But hey, he never smoked. And then she had
I'm
liquor
sorry
around,
to laugh.
And he didn't drink. And then he had that huge insurance policy. So she just made a few, if you could excuse the expression, fatal mistakes that implicated her.
No kidding.
and so it's really a lot harder than you think. Now that you take somebody else who doesn't have an IQ of 135 like Alcala or 138 like Whitaker, this fellow Gary Ridgway, the Green River Killer.
Green River
IQ
Killer,
82,
yeah.
You figure, he's not that clever. But what he, but he just threw away these women, these prostitutes at the side of the river, and he kept it going for something like 18 years. so that there's some of them that, through a kind of dismissive carelessness, get rid of a body in some woods somewhere or just some place, or they also go after prostitutes or people that the public doesn't care as much about as a girl from better circumstances. And so they get away with it without even being all that clever. It's the ones that are especially clever that often make a dumb mistake that they took 107 things in consideration, but it's 108 thing that they didn't think of that nailed them.
They didn't think of, yeah. It's like the Lieutenant Columbo syndrome, you know. It seemed like it was always the really smart guy in the room that Lieutenant Columbo grabbed and pulled down, the guy that thought he outsmarted Lieutenant Columbo. Hey, Dr. Stone, another great visit with you. And again, the hour is gone like that, and I certainly wish that we had more time. Thank you so much. We'll see you next month.
Terrific. Look forward.
Outstanding. All right, Dr. Michael Stone on Crime Night. Folks, coming up next, it is Professor Emery Clayton, and we're going to be talking more about this rancorous and ugly atmosphere surrounding the health care bill and these emails about Michelle Obama, etc. World-famous Phil Hendry Show.
Phil Hendry.